Hi, and welcome to the Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff at Dermatology Times, aiming to provide you with the latest updates in dermatology, to exclusive interviews with leading industry experts, and a glimpse of what goes on behind the scenes. I'm your host, Morgan Petronelli. With the summer months quickly approaching, we're discussing the importance of skin cancer screenings, as well as encouraging regular sun protection usage among patients. This episode also touches on the role of telemedicine in skin cancer screenings, top product recommendations for sun protection, and tips on managing patient expectations if the patient is diagnosed with skin cancer. Let's dive right in. Today I have joining me Dr. Melissa Stenstrom, board-certified dermatologist at MD Skin Center in Rockford, Illinois, assistant clinical professor for the University of Illinois Rockford, member of the American Academy of Dermatology, and a member of the American Society for Dermatologic Surgeons. All right, so my first question is, you know, with the summer months quickly approaching, you know, can you kind of explain why it's so integral for physicians to communicate the importance of skin cancer screenings as well as regular sun protection usage with their patients?
Sure. So skin cancer is on an alarming rise. And although the majority of skin cancers are non-melanoma skin cancer, only about 4% are melanoma, but those account for like 75% of the skin cancer related deaths. And melanoma is often a silent skin cancer. It doesn't have any symptoms. So screening patients, detecting these things early can really reduce the morbidity and the mortality that we're seeing with melanoma. So we're entering that time of the year where there are modifiable risk factors, reducing those sunburns and using this sunscreen that can really reduce our risk.
Absolutely. My next question, you know, what types of patients should doctors really focus on pushing sun protection to? Like, is there like, you know, people with fair skin, like myself, you know, or anything like that?
Yeah. So certainly fair skin types, people who are tendency to freckle, people who have lots of moles, like greater than 100 moles, those people are going to be at a little higher risk of skin cancer. Also, people who work outdoors occupationally. So those who are, you know, think construction workers, truck drivers, gardeners, people who are outside every day, they really need to be educated on the importance of a daily sunscreen routine. And then lastly, you know, special populations, transplant patients or people who are on immunosuppressive agents, those patients are at great risk for skin cancer, particularly squamous cell carcinoma.
And my next question, you know, Dermatology Times conducted a podcast interview in November 2020 about racial disparities in melanoma awareness, with researchers finding that skin cancer awareness among skin of color patients was significantly lower than those with lighter skin types. You know, despite melanoma's ability to affect all skin types, is there still a perception amongst people with skin of color that sun protection is not needed due to their dark skin types? Could you provide some strategies on how to communicate the importance of sun protection and skin cancer screenings with this patient population, since, you know, they are so like, oh, you know, I don't need it. You know, I have a lot of melanin in my skin. You know, I'll be fine. I don't really burn. What would you say?
Yeah, definitely. So unfortunately, although melanoma is a decreased incidence in that patient population, it is often caught at later stages, and the morbidity and the mortality of melanoma and skin of color is higher. Therefore, I think a lot of people really believe it starts at the research level, that we need to have some well-constructed, thorough studies on these underrepresented racial populations so that we can help to strategize, focusing those skin exams in skin of color on subungual areas around the nails, acral sites, so kind of educating on where they might look, particularly for the signs of skin cancer, is important. And then just also, you know, sun protection is, of course, preventing skin cancer, but also helping with those signs of aging. And we all want to avoid that. So I think pushing that as well. But I think it really begins at research level and also leadership level, having more dermatologists and healthcare professionals in these underrepresented minorities so that they can help to lead our future.
So my next question, you know, within recent years, some aspects of sun protection have become controversial. You know, what are some current controversies, you know, an example, controversial ingredients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so although we know that sunscreen over and over has been supported in the literature to reduce skin sunburns and to reduce skin cancer, there are many controversies. So the first one probably is whether or not these chemical blockers that are in sunscreens are systemically absorbed. So there was a study that evaluated about six different chemical ingredients, and all six were shown to be somewhat systemically absorbed at levels that were higher than the FDA threshold. However, there was no harm that was proven in these studies. So the FDA is reevaluating some of these chemical ingredients to ensure that they're safe to use, so, and whether or not they cause actual harm to the skin or to the body when absorbed. So that's one big one. Another one is environmental concerns. And so as of January 2021, Hawaii has banned certain ingredients that might harm the chemical, the coral reefs. And so those ingredients are going to be banned. And in general, mineral-based sunscreens like zinc or titanium-based sunscreens are going to be probably the preferred type of sunscreens in those areas. Then always there's the hot topic of vitamin D in the skin. So vitamin D deficiency is pretty common, and it leads to other health problems as well. And so we wonder about whether people who practice very strict photo minimization or use sunscreen on a regular basis are going to be at higher risks of the vitamin D deficiency. Luckily, vitamin D is easily measured and also very treatable just with oral supplementation. And the correlation between strict UV minimization and vitamin D deficiency is still not kind of all that proven. So,
you know, something that I am personally seeing is a recent big push in sun protection on social media. You know, have you personally seen a difference in the prevalence of sun protection usage amongst your patients? You know, if so, what do they attribute this usage to?
Yeah. So I have, and I was just talking to my niece about this as well, she's 14, but I think a couple things. So I think melanoma awareness became much more out there when social media came about. Young people realized that melanoma can be a disease of young people who are generally otherwise healthy. And so seeing a few of those stories, I think, brought that to an awareness. Then I think there was a push, a difference in the cosmetic elegance of sunscreens, as well as the marketing of sunscreens to that patient population. So a lot of times now skincare creams will be combined with the sunscreen. And then lastly, the beauty influencers. So the beauty influencers who really understand that sunscreen is kind of the most anti-aging thing that they can put on their skin, and have kind of supported it in that way too. So I think that was kind of the progression.
Yeah, absolutely. I like your point about how, you know, it really affects people at young ages too. I know someone in my life who was 22 years old and had it from, you know, going to the tanning bed all the time and got it on her ear and thought it was a mole and nope, it's melanoma. And so, you know, I think it's really important to, you know, really pound it into your patients' heads, like, hey, like, doesn't matter, like, you know, any age, like, wear your sunscreen. So definitely good advice.
Absolutely.
You know, so what are your top general product recommendations for sun protection? You know, an example, you know, any sunscreens, hats, or anything like that. I've seen even sun shields.
Yes. So overall, the foundations would be minimizing that UV exposure during those hours between like 10 and 2, 10 and 3, when the sun is the strongest. So if you can work in the shade during those hours, that's important. Sun protective clothing, I think, would be second. So especially for people who work outdoors, wide-brimmed hats, UPF clothing, so UPF 50 clothing is pretty widely available now on the internet. There are sleeves that people can buy. Sometimes they're called cool sleeves or sun protective sleeves, and they're really lightweight, but they afford people the opportunity to work outdoors without having to reapply sunscreen every couple of hours, or golfers, they really like these as well. So UV minimization and sun protective clothing would definitely be the foundation. Sunscreen, of course, is an integral part, but reapplying every 2 hours is really important. That's usually, so 30 or higher SPF is what we recommend, but the reapplication every 1.5 to 2 hours is really the part where it gets a little tricky, and often people sunburn because they think that they don't have to reapply if they use a higher SPF, and that's not true. So reapplying those sunscreens every 2 hours is important.
If a possible sign of skin cancer is discovered, how do you manage your patient's expectations when it comes to diagnosis, follow-ups, and treatments?
So I like to get to the problem as quickly as possible for the patients. If I mention that there's a suspicion and then they have to go home for 2 weeks and think about that, they get quite nervous. So I usually try to biopsy right at the time of the visit, whenever possible. That alleviates their fears. It lets them know that we are on a treatment plan and we're going to figure it out quickly. When I do diagnose a skin cancer, then I let them know that they're in the right place. So we diagnose and deal with skin cancers. I think last year in our clinic, we had almost 1,800 skin cancers that we treated and diagnosed. So, I let them know that we're well-tuned to deal with these problems, that we have the plan in place. I usually ask them to bring a family member if they seem very concerned, so they have a second set of ears. I let them know that any questions that they have, they should write down. And then I usually offer a visit or at least a telephone call the following day, particularly in the case of melanoma, where there can be a lot of questions and there's a lot of internet searches that lead to other information that they're gathering. So just making sure that I let them know I'll be their resource throughout the way. And then lastly, just giving them power, education about their own skin, doing those self-skin exams, letting them know what they're watching for. All of those things help them feel empowered that they're in control of their skin. And then I let them know that we're going to have a close relationship and we'll guide them along the way.
That's some great advice. And, you know, my next question is, the pandemic has presented hurdles in direct patient care and monitoring. You know, as practices offered nearly full telemedicine services since last summer, what are the unique particularities for telemedicine screening and care for dermatologic patients, especially those at risk of skin cancer?
Yeah, so I think teledermatology works really well for some aspects of dermatology. Unfortunately, there's a little discordance between an in-office visit and a teledermatology visit for full body skin exams, for pigmented lesions. So we're really, dermatologists are used to looking through a dermatoscope at high power and identifying those features that give us good clinical confidence that we know what that lesion is. So without that, I think that generally the recommendation would be to have these patients who need full body skin exams or who have a high risk of melanoma and have a lot of pigmented lesions, especially, to come into the office for their exams. At my office, we use a protocol, a pre-screening protocol, to kind of let us know who might be a good candidate for one or the other. And that's been helpful. And there have been occasions where I'll do a telemedicine visit and then ask them to come into the office so I can see the lesion more clearly. It definitely has been helpful in some cases. Precancerous lesions, actinic keratoses, and treating those with field therapy has been something that we've done a lot of over teledermatology.
My next question, you know, on the same note, recent data suggests in some ways teledermatology may be more cost-effective than conventional care and with minimal sacrifice to quality of care provided. How do you imagine teledermatology persists beyond COVID-19?
Yeah, it's been great for management of chronic skin diseases. So things like acne, atopic dermatitis, well-controlled psoriasis on biologic therapy. These patients are they know their treatment plan, they know what medications they're on, and we've had the discussion in office, and now they're just kind of on cruise control. So for those patients just checking in every 6 to 12 months, it has been a perfect addition to our practice and probably one of the good things that's come out of the past year. Especially like isotretinoin patients who require frequent in-office visits, and they're usually high school or college kids. They might even have moved away for the summer, or I'm sorry, for the school year, and made it difficult to come into those visits. Now we have this avenue that allows it easy to access.
And, you know, the relative to established and emerging methods of dermatologic care, from invasive procedures to new therapies, you know, what does a modern dermatology care team look like in terms of staff roles? And, you know, how do you expect it to continue to change?
Yeah. So in our clinic, our staff really is a huge support. So the medical assistants, they act as scribes. They hear everything I say. They know the disease states. They often know the therapeutics, the side effects. And so after a visit, whether it's just right after counseling that patient or reiterating what I've said or taking the phone calls, they're able to educate the patients really well. They assist with the procedures. The RNs also can assist with these procedures and provide medication teaching on biologic therapies. So they can spend a lot of counseling time with the patient as well, which is fully directed and there's protocols in place. So it's just an extension of what I would be telling them, but they're able to reiterate and really spend a lot of time. They also spend a lot of time with prior authorizations and medication management, and that allows the patient to access medications that would be very difficult for them to navigate that situation on their own. And then we have nurse practitioners in my office that we have a very collaborative relationship, and that allows, in my area, dermatology is pretty underserved, and a lot of times the wait time to get into a dermatologist is over 100 days. So by having this close relationship with the nurse practitioners in my office, we are able to see some of these patients a little quicker, but they know that I'm collaborating on each and every patient with them. So
yeah, the wait times is for sure true. So like, I know it's really hard where I live in Cleveland to even, you know, get, even find a doctor that's taking new patients or anything. So, it's definitely a struggle, but I'm sure all those people definitely, you know, get things rolling a lot quicker.
The other part of the care team, which I didn't mention, is medical students and residents. So I have a collaborative agreement with the local university, and that is kind of helping us to improve this access program. So I have a couple of medical students that we're doing a study right now to see if, just with a few screening questions, if somebody calls in with a lesion of concern, can we ask them a quick bit of screening questions to know if that's a lesion of concern that needs to be gotten in sooner, quicker than 100 days, whether it has concerning features for melanoma or rapidly growing non-melanoma skin cancer. So that has been a helpful part of my care team too.
That's awesome. You know, and, you know, we understand you volunteer for free skin cancer screening drives, you know, which is awesome. Can you describe the benefit of strategies that provide cancer risk individuals direct and free screening? You know, in your opinion, is skin cancer screening a needed improvement in the U.S.?
So yeah, I think we need more data. So unfortunately, the U.S. Preventive Task Force has not been able to argue for or against routine screening in the general population. So we know that the American Cancer Society, they do recommend screening every 3 years in people under 40 and annually over 40. That could be with their primary care doctor during their routine visit with them, or could be with a dermatologist. But knowing that melanoma often is asymptomatic and doesn't have any symptoms that they might notice, it's important to have a medical care provider who understands and knows the signs of melanoma looking at someone's skin probably annually. Our free skin cancer screening is done through the cancer center here. And so we are kind of self-selecting a little bit a population of patients who might be at a little higher risk, whether it's due to some of their medications or other factors. But it's also, you know, throughout the community, there is advertisement so that everybody knows it's going to happen. And we often have repeat people who come every year, and they look forward to that convenience and also to the reassurance that they're going to get that screening annually.
And on another note, in recent years, promising biologic therapies have emerged as, you know, a disease-modifying agents for dermatologic conditions, while also kind of making ground in treating other inflammatory diseases. To your perspective, you know, what is the current prescriber confidence in biologics for dermatology? And, you know, what is the average eligible patient's interest in such an agent?
So I think biologic therapy is one of the most exciting innovations in my career as a dermatologist. So these medications are life-changing. They are extremely effective. They're relatively safe compared to a lot of the previous medications and immunosuppressants that we had. So as each new medication has been approved, they've gotten more affordable as well. Just the price of the medication to the patient has really improved so that they're very affordable. And because of all that, I think both prescribers' confidence and the patient's confidence in these medications is very high. They're seeing at times a lot of commercials, but they're that just awareness that they're out there and that there's lots of patients on them and they've been out for now decades, some of them, has really improved our prescribers' confidence in these medications. And I'm really excited about some of the off-label medication or off-label uses for these medications or the future medications that are going to come out for some of the disease states that are difficult to treat right now, like vitiligo.
Absolutely. You know, and on another note now, we also understand you're a member of the American Academy of Dermatology. You know, is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to at the upcoming AAD virtual meeting?
I do think actually I saw on the schedule that there's going to be a complete lecture on off-label uses for biologic therapy. So I'm interested to hear about that. I always love the hot topic section. There's a few sessions on that and just hearing the experts talk about what's happening in dermatology. But after a year of relative isolation, I'm really just excited to hear from the experts in our field. Dermatology is so broad, and having all these subspecialists in one place and being able to hear how they do it in their particular clinics is just so exciting. And I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For more Dermatology Times content, from articles and videos to podcasts, you can visit www.dermatologytimes.com.